You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 11th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hello.
And Evan Bernstein.
And a sad moment as on this day, well, February 21, when you're listening to this show, in 1741, English writer and pioneer, gentleman who invented the horse-drawn drill, died, and his name was, of course, Jethro Tull. So we tip our hats to the late,
Tull.
Great Jethro
that's
Tull.
That's where the name
Man,
comes
that's
from?
A band.
There you go.
That's where the name of the band got their
yes.
name.
Exactly correct.
Well, yeah, but what is a horse-drawn drill?
But he's like a folk hero. I mean, he's not known for that, right? He's more of a folk hero.
I guess
hero,
he is more of a folk hero and for some other things.
Do folk
that he
heroes
did well.
Have dates of death?
He was big in agriculture experiments, and he, you know, he had a little place in science, so.
Evan, I have a related joke for that. You want to hear it?
I do. I can't wait.
Okay, knock, knock.
Who's there?
A pile up.
Pile
of who?
I lied. It wasn't actually related. It was. I just wanted to hear you say a pile of poo.
Oh, God.
We can keep going.
Rebecca, you should have put that on the 5x5 because only a kid can appreciate that joke.
So we're recording this on the 11th because Jay, Bob, and I are all going to be on vacation next week. So this is the
Don't
podcast.
Don't worry, everybody. I'll still be here.
Yeah, this is the podcast for the week that we're going to be away, so we have to do it early.
Holding down the home fort.
And we are vacationing together. And you know we're going to miss like the biggest news cycle in two decades, and we're talking about Jethro Tull. And meanwhile, there's an asteroid heading for the Earth.
Maybe I should do. I'll record just a one person.
I'll do it.
And,
I'll do it, Rebecca. We'll be two by two, 22
me,
minutes
me
with
and
two
Evan.
Skeptics.
Me and Evan will do it.
Yeah, send me any updates for next week if something really big happens.
Definitely.
Bob, you know you're a real news whore when you come up with like an asteroid hitting the Earth as a hot news item and you're not like, you know, wouldn't you be more like running in fear or, you know.
Being with loved ones.
Yeah. Bob's like, but I wouldn't get the podcast about it.
Our ratings are going to go through the roof.
But if it's two decades away, we got time to talk.
I have wasted my life.
Right. So while we're recording this, it's a day before Darwin Day. February 12th, again, is Darwin Day. I know we've been talking a lot about this for the past couple of shows, but there's still news coming out about it. First news item we're going to talk about tonight also deals with Darwin and the Pope. Recently, the Vatican admitted that Charles Darwin pretty much had it right all along, and they officially say they have no problem with Darwin or with evolution even of people.
Well, that's a huge load off.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely.
I was holding my breath.
It was scary there for a little while. We weren't sure what this new pope was thinking, because he kind of made some allusions to intelligent design or something. It was kind of ambiguous where he was coming from. So this is a relief of sorts, you know, because he seemed to be going backwards there for a while. But
yeah, it ends the speculation that he was about to endorse intelligent design. That's out now.
3 years ago, advocates of intelligent design seized on the Pope's reference to an intelligent project as so-called proof that he favored their views. But apparently that's not going to be the official stance.
Back in 2007, he said evolution can't be proven. Mm-hmm. He's still no friend of science.
No,
yeah.
He's conservative. He's pretty old school
bad,
when it
yeah.
comes to this stuff. I don't. It's interesting. I know he is the Pope and all that, and there's kind of this one figure. But really, how much of this stuff is decided by committees and panels and officials and so forth? I mean, you know, they have more. It's more like a PR. It's more like a political campaign.
Place.
It's more like, you know, putting PR spin on certain things and, you know, handling it like. Very much more political than religious.
But yeah, this is not some offhand comment. This is a fairly official event that's being hosted by there's a papal-backed conference this month on the origin of species and on evolution. And to give you an idea of where they're headed with this, it was even proposed for the conference, it's reported, that any discussion of intelligent design be banned. Because it is, quote, poor theology and poor science.
Yeah, but they are still going to discuss it, but just not in a scientific terms.
Yeah, it'll be at the fringes of the conference as a cultural phenomenon, not as a scientific or even theological issue. So they're saying it's both bad religion and bad science, and it's only now just a cultural curiosity. That's what it's been relegated to.
That's a great point of view. I like that.
I just find it so incredibly frustrating that we have to care what these idiots have to say about anything.
I totally agree, Rebecca. It's like, oh, okay.
They're not scientists.
Why don't you just wait another 100 years?
Yeah. Why don't you let us know what you think about gravity next? Because I'm really on the edge of my seat. Literally,
yeah, the Pope
on the
agrees
edge of my
with
seat.
Gravity. It's like, come on.
Rebecca, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying, and I agree. Ultimately, I do agree, but on the other side of that coin, though, I think this is important because so many times creationists and intelligent designers they throw up the false dichotomy that it's either evolution or religion, and that false dichotomy doesn't hold. So it's kind of important to show that you can be religious and believe in this science thing at the same time. So,
well,
that,
Bob,
from that
I
point
didn't,
of view,
I did not mean to imply that it's not important. What I said was that okay. I find it frustrating that it is important.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be.
Okay.
Nobody
right.
on the planet should care what the Pope has to say about evolution. Unfortunately, millions of people care about what the Pope has to say about evolution, and therefore we have to, you know, pay attention.
Yeah,
and I just find it very frustrating.
I totally understand where you're coming from, Rebecca. It is frustrating.
But I think that... Yeah, of course I agree with that, and certainly the Pope's opinion or the papacy's opinion on science is largely irrelevant to science. Scientists don't really need to care about what a religious figure's beliefs on science are. But as Bob was saying, it has an effect on society, on culture. Unfortunately, this is a culture that we live in. This is what we deal with when we're talking about teaching evolution in public school systems. So this absolutely has an influence on that. What I'm hoping to see here, and actually we're going to be interviewing Kenneth Miller in a couple of weeks, so maybe we'll talk about this with him. He's a Catholic biologist who has been on the front lines against intelligent design and creationism. And so he certainly has written a lot about the notion of, Christianity in particular, but religion in general, evolving towards a philosophy that does not have a problem with science, and that it's really a failed strategy to make your religious belief subservient to or dependent upon certain scientific findings or scientific beliefs. If you say that in order to have faith in our religion, you have to have these scientific views, that's a setup for failure because science is changing. And science finds what it does. And if you put yourself in a position where you're backing an incorrect scientific notion, then that is a long term, that's going to be a failed strategy. I think in the short term, this false dichotomy of religion versus science, or in this case versus evolution, is very bad for the teaching of science and for public acceptance and belief in science, especially specific things like evolution. But I think in the long run, it's worse for the faith that does that because they're going against the tide of history.
That's an interesting perspective, Steve, and I have to agree. I see the logic in what you're saying. Just where I sit today from a very narrow perspective, it's just frustrating because I hate to see science be hindered by religion. The two, in my opinion, should be mutually exclusive, and the fact is that religion does have a dramatic effect on the advancement of science, and we can, a perfect example would be the past 8 years of George Bush running the United States and the damage that he did to science.
The next news item has to do with Ben Goldacre and his dealings with Jenny Barnett, who is a radio show host who was talking recently about the whole MMR vaccine issue.
Ben has a unique knack for getting in trouble with quacks. I didn't mean to make that rhyme, actually. That sounded weird. Yeah, Ben recently called out, as Steve said, a woman named Jenny, who is, she basically broadcast a 40-minute tirade against vaccines, particularly MMR. It was so astonishing and so full of inaccuracies and half-truths and just made-up bunkum that Ben didn't even feel that it was possible for him to compose a blog post that would encompass all of the idiocy of the clip. So what he did was he took the clip, cut it out of her show, and posted it on his blog with just, you know, here, have at it, so that his readers could listen and be horrified. And horrified they were, because it really is one of the worst pieces of garbage you'll ever hear, and she has quite a large audience, apparently. The radio station on which she's broadcast, LBC, demanded that Ben remove the clip from his website under threat of legal action. So Ben, who is not a billionaire, decided to take the clip down, despite the fact that it is possible that it falls under England's version of fair use law, which is it's like fair something else. But it's basically the same idea, where you're legally allowed to take bits and pieces of something if it's to make to add your own commentary to it. However, considering that it was 40-some minutes of unadulterated BS that he had just posted, he would definitely be setting some kind of precedent. He would have to go to court over it. They would be backed up by billions of dollars, and he would be pretty much on his own. So he pulled the clip down. That's the bad news. But the good news is that the internet kind of exploded around this. And if you guys remember last year what happened with the Church of Scientology, when they demanded that someone take down the clips of Tom Cruise acting like a lunatic, same thing happened here, where hundreds of other blogs kind of stepped forward and picked up the audio and reposted it, first in little bits and pieces, and then finally it made it onto a number of sites, full 40-minute glory. You can find it still on YouTube if you just do a search, or if you go to Ben's site, he has links to pretty much everything. It's really terrible. And the only reason why I can imagine that they wanted this to be taken down is because she comes across as such a crazy, dangerous idiot.
Yeah, I listened to the whole thing, and I listened to a lot of craziness. And that was 45 minutes of the most ignorant, bloviating, stupid nonsense I've heard in a long time. She was just throwing out these ridiculous arguments and completely made up facts. It was unbelievable.
And then she even tore into a nurse. One nurse managed to get through the lines amidst a bunch of parents calling in to support Jenny on her anti-vax crap. Speaking of, is there something with the name Jenny and anti-vaccinationists? But anyway, one nurse got through and made a very polite but forceful argument in favor of vaccines.
She was fantastic, and actually.
She was. She was very good. But then Jenny, in the days following, has accused that nurse of being bitter and angry, and the nurse is now considering taking action against Jenny for the rude comments she said about her since. But she was perfectly polite. I mean, few people will make it past even the beginning of the clip when she's talking about how, sure, you know, back in the day, one out of 15 kids died of measles, but, I mean, shouldn't we be just looking at why that one kid died and not stop everybody from
But the other 14 did okay. That's basically
right.
What she said.
Yeah, and she made it sound like we're calling the herd. I mean, she's really awful.
If I tried to craft the stupidest things to possibly say on this topic, I could not do better than what she did. Now, another thing, she was completely hypocritical. She was railing against them. She obviously doesn't like the medical establishment at all. And her reason why vaccines have to be bad because pharmaceutical companies make money off of them. That was it. That was her logic. Oh, they're making money off of them. They must be bad. And she said that doctors engage in fear-mongering in order to get patients to use vaccines,
which is exactly what she's
and then she
doing.
And then she goes on this tirade of fear mongering, saying she read an email from somebody that was unattributed that said that there are cancer causing agents in vaccines. Wrong. That's a lie. It's a fear mongering lie, and she had the gall to accuse the medical establishment of fear mongering. It was the most incredible hypocrisy that you could imagine. And Ben is right. You can't do justice to it. You have to listen to it. You know, in fact, I downloaded and made a copy of the whole thing, and I'm going to include the clip with the nurse, which is actually I my favorite bit from the whole thing.
Yeah,
just to give you a taste. So I'm going to include the clip at this point.
Well, you'd be surprised, and at the moment we are expecting a measles epidemic, and it's because of people like Ken Livingstone, people like yourself. You talk about young mothers who have a very difficult decision to make, and I agree, they do, and I spend a lot of time talking to them, but people like you don't really make it any easier for them. And you're just talking about somebody with an ear infection. Well, I've been told every day.
And so do I, as a parent, and that's what I'm saying.
I'm a parent, and one of my children has had 3 doses of measles, and, you know, there's no problem with it.
But if she's
had 100 doses of measles and it would do nothing.
Why give them the vaccine if they get the measles? I never can understand that.
We don't give vaccines to measles to children who have had measles. They need a combined vaccine of measles, mumps and rubella. If they have one dose, the studies show that they possibly need to be revaccinated within a couple of years to make sure that protection goes on through life.
Do you not think, though, that as a parent, I am allowed to make a decision about what I put in my kid's body?
Yes, and do you not think that a parent whose child has cancer and is having chemotherapy has a much lower resistance to things like measles, mumps and rubella has a right to their child to
Absolutely.
Go to a normal primary school, but because there may be one child in the class, such as yours, who is lucky to have decent immunity, that child might get measles, mumps or rubella and die.
Yasmin, my daughter did not have decent immunity, which is exactly why I didn't have
inoculated. Well, we wait until your child is well and fit enough to give the MMR.
But I don't want my child to be fiddled with all sorts of stuff that's in a vaccine. Now, let me finish.
Could you tell me what's in the vaccine? What do you think is in the vaccine? Well, then how can you make a decision for your child? You're talking about parents having to make decisions for the child, but if you go into any secondary school, which I have done, and we've been asked to vaccinate kids against MMR, they all say they want it. If you deny immunisation, you're denying health to your child and other children.
No, my child is absolutely strong and healthy in many ways.
Well, you're one of the lucky ones, aren't you? Your kid had chemotherapy and that sort of thing.
Steve, is there a way to reverse an MMR vaccine in people?
No.
That's too bad. Well, I'd like to unvaccinate some of these people.
Well, you'd have to cloister them, Bob. Put them on an island or something.
Yeah, that's the big problem. That, you know, the couple people brought up, you know, people with actual medical knowledge who got through the phone lines, that even in best case scenario, the MMR is only about 95% effective. That's pretty damn good, but that still means that 5% of the people who actually get the vaccine or are trying to be responsible may not be covered, or people may be sick and not be able to get the vaccines because they're fighting off cancer or they have some other chronic illness. And those people are now vulnerable to these infections because of other people who are perfectly healthy and for whom getting the vaccine would be actually individually the better decision for them. But they're burdened with parents who are either victimized by misinformation or who are themselves promoting anti-scientific, you know, quackery and are putting other, not only their children, but other children at harm. And then they're defending that by saying that I have the right to make this decision and you can't take this right away from me. It's really an incredible argument.
They're not just putting at risk the 5% on whom the vaccines don't happen to work, but they're also hurting. I mean, there are pregnant women who you know, could contract it and it could have serious effects on their unborn child. And also, there are newborn babies. You can't vaccinate the baby right out of the womb. So they're at risk, and we have to build up that herd immunity, and we can't do it when people like Jenny are freaking out like that.
Yeah, they're still, and Ben's point on covering this is the issue about the MMR and autism. We've talked about that a lot. It's the science is fairly well settled, but his point is to talk about the media, the responsibility of the media in reporting scientific and especially medical information, and that this was an absolutely irresponsible thing to do from a journalistic and a media point of view. That's really where he focused his criticism, and that's what also often gets him in quote-unquote trouble, meaning he ruffles the feathers of people who do have a lot of money and a lot of lawyers behind them in the media. But that's his job, and he does it very, very well. And he made a good point that we absolutely need this kind of public discourse. And what does it say about her and her company that they're trying to shut down public discourse about this very important issue, not only the vaccine, but the responsibility of media? It also makes a complete hypocrite out of her. Many of the things that she said directly, on that show. So it is, again, just adds a whole layer of stupidity and hypocrisy to the whole issue.
Right, and earlier I compared it to the Scientologist yanking the Tom Cruise video offline. I really hope we see the same sort of backlash that we've seen against Scientology go towards the anti-vax things.
Yeah, really, in the age of the internet, I think people are slowly learning that trying to squash information just causes – it's like cutting off the head of a hydra, four grow back. It doesn't work in the age of the internet. Well, let's go on. Bob, tell us about this new instant laser healing technology.
So I was scanning Science News links yesterday. I started seeing articles with titles like Doctor's Demo, Star Trek Healing Laser. So, of course, that got my attention. I had to check it out. And what I found was even better than I even had hoped. Irene Kachiever and Robert Redmond of the Wellman Center for Photomedicine in Massachusetts General Hospital, they've created a method for using lasers to close wounds better than conventional stitches or using a needle and thread. Laser healing, it seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Shouldn't lasers cause wounds or at least stun you, right? Wait, that's a phaser, not a laser. Never mind.
Bob, how does it make the flesh adhere to itself?
Some people call it like a welding. They're welding the skin, kind of. And that's actually not a bad analogy. But when they first were looking at lasers to do this, and they've been looking at ways to do this for a long time, it's very difficult because if the laser light is too weak, then really nothing happens. And of course, if it's too strong, you get third degree burns. But it occurred to somebody that maybe they should focus on the light itself and not the heat. And that was a key idea, because that's where chemical dyes come into the picture. Have you ever gone to an eye doctor and he puts a dye in your eye?
Sure.
So one of the dyes that these ophthalmologists use is called Rose Bengal, which is a type of stain, and they put it on your eye to see if there's like lesions and stuff, because the contrast would really bring the lesion out. So what they do is they use this dye, this Rose Bengal dye or stain, and they put that into an open wound, and then they use the light, the laser light, which actually activates the dye. And then when that happens, it's an interesting process. Electrons flow out of this dye, and they create these free radicals. And when the free radicals get in contact with your skin's collagen, the supporting structure of your skin, the collagen, the free radicals are very reactive, and they cause the molecular chains of collagen to bond to one another, and which basically knits the skin back together. Yeah. Kachiever says that regarding this, she said, we call this nano-suturing. Because what you're doing is linking together the little collagen fibers. It's way beyond anything that a thread of any kind can do, she says. So this is a really interesting process. The results they've had have been pretty incredible. The wounds heal faster. There's less scarring. The bond that's created between the flaps of skin is very strong, and it's watertight. So that means that infection should be much, much lower, because there's no, in between normal stitches, it's open skin. So bacteria can easily get in. But when it's completely shut, it's a watertight barrier. I mean, not everybody's completely convinced that this is, a miracle. Robert Stern is a professor of dermatology in Harvard. Harvard Medical School, he said that he's hopeful about this as well, but he said that this technology still has to prove itself in terms of cost-benefit. And he does have a point, because how much does a needle and thread cost? I mean, yeah, that's pretty cheap. And when I first read that, I was like, wow, that's actually a good point. You know, they might have this great technology, but it costs 10 times as much as a stupid needle and thread, and it might never get used.
Well, is it better?
Well, absolutely. It's absolutely better, but it's a cost-benefit, Jay. Are the benefits worth the extra cost?
Yeah.
But actually, it might not cost that much more than you think, because the Irene Kachiva actually addressed that point specifically in a video she saw. She said that eventually all you're really going to need is a small laser, you know, like a laser pointer, maybe a little bit bigger than a laser pointer, and they'll have these disposable little packets of dye. So you just squeeze out the dye, do the laser, and bam, that doesn't sound like it's going to be too expensive to me. And if they offered me the choice, I would easily pay the extra amount for less scarring and less infection.
Bob, can you see this being used in the field, like in the military or on an ambulance? Like, is this the kind of thing that would...
Absolutely. Actually, Kachiva is very, very optimistic. She thinks that this is going to be in clinical use in 3 years. And the next step is actually to submit this to the U.S. United States Food and Drug Administration for approval. And then once that happens, then they'll do the next round of human trials. And animal experiments have already had great success with nerves and eyes and blood vessels, wow, which are important, because skin is one thing, but, you know, nerve and eyes and blood vessels, the utility there, I think, is much greater, because it's hard to suture a nerve or eyes. You know, so this could really be a boon for things like that. Now, keep in mind that there are limitations. It's not a panacea. Deep tissue will still need to be sutured, because light can't penetrate that far, so you can't really use it for the deep tissue. And it also won't work on dark or opaque tissue like liver and bone. But otherwise, I think this looks awesome. But there's only one other problem. The Star Trek comparison was not a very good one. They should have gone with Logan's Run. That was a much better example.
Yeah, come on, guys. Get your
science
fiction right.
I guess they just aren't nerdy enough.
Damn scientists.
Right.
This makes you think, like, one day they're going to look back and go, could you imagine they actually... Wait, didn't McCoy from Star Trek say this? Could you imagine they actually stitched people together with needle and thread?
Like your great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Oh, my God. Right out of Star Trek.
True.
Oh, man.
It's true.
Good episode.
Well, let's go on to your email. The first email comes from Tony Potts in London, and Tony writes, after a little bit of introduction, where he just gives us some general praise and feedback, he writes, given the rate at which much of the population of the internet seems to be pushing back the Enlightenment, I suppose that I should not be surprised at all when I come across a new piece of craziness, but I must admit, I am often still stunned when one person's really off-the-wall delusions seem to catch the mood of a group and are taken up as genuine beliefs. As an example that I came across today, the self-styled starseeds. It appears that there are a good few people who genuinely believe that they are aliens, sent here with alien DNA for a higher purpose and to help humanity. Here is a typical site. Then he gives us a link, and he goes on to discuss a little bit more. So, Bob, you looked into the whole starseed situation. Get us up to
speed. Yeah, if you thought that the holographic thing we were talking about a couple weeks ago, if you thought that was wacky, then you haven't looked at these starseed people. I checked out that website and a couple other ones, and wow, as the name implies, the star seeds are supposed to be human people who are literally not of this earth. Here are some of the attributes that have been attributed to these people. They have alien DNA, mm-hmm, and they've been coming to Earth from other planets, solar systems, stars, galaxies, dimensions even, since the beginning of Earth's history. So that's quite a chunk of time that they've been here.
But only from parallel dimensions, not from tangential or askew ones.
That goes without saying. So as they reincarnate over and over, apparently they're learning all sorts of lessons about being human and learning things and absorbing things. And they're also genetically programmed in some way to awaken at some point and realize, you know, what they are.
The sleeper must awaken.
And what their mission is.
Right, Bob?
And I guess it also seems like they're all waiting for an event in 2012 it's called now The Gathering, where they chop off each other's heads off while chanting,
no, you're confused.
There can only be one.
You're confused.
Oh, wait, no, wait, sorry. I got my notes mixed up. Oh, here it is.
You got your science fiction mixed up.
They're waiting for something called The Awakening in 2012. Yeah. And there's that date again. There's got to be something about that, right? Because everybody's talking about it.
There's got to be. They wouldn't all make it up.
Right? Right? What are the odds?
Yeah, can't just
but
be
luckily, the Awakening, though, it's not Armageddon. It's not the Second Coming.
It's nothing testable or anything.
They do, right. You just got to wait, I guess. But you got to. They describe it as simply a new world or change, a change. But didn't that already happen January 20th? I don't get it.
Maybe I'll get a new sweater.
Just here's a quote. Let me throw you a quote.
Talk about open-ended criteria. Yeah, right? Things will change in some totally defined way. And we'll tell you after the change happens what it was.
And then we'll tell you that
don't
we'll
worry,
prophesize
you'll know.
It.
You'll know it when it happens.
I hope nothing interesting happens that year. So here's a quote from a star seeder. I'm calling this person a star seeder. She or he says, I've known since I was 10 that I was this. It was confirmed with my soul reading, and I've actually learned where I come from. The Orion system, and then I was in Sirius, as well as Pleiades.
She's serious?
I've always had visions of a sky in the shades of lavender with two orbs in the sky, but I didn't know if they were moons or suns. And she goes on.
I love it when psychics or whatever claim to be from the Pleiades because it's a sexy name.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Pleiades. It sounds cool. But the Pleiades is a nursery of new stars. There's like no planets or they haven't been there long enough for you to expect there to be any advanced life or civilization.
Steve, they're star people.
Yes. Right. But Bob, if they have alien DNA, that sounds testable. What's alien about their DNA?
Absolutely. Of course, they don't go into that detail, but that is a good point. That is something that you could actually be determined. But, you know, it doesn't matter. They'd come up with some out or something silly. Oh, it's encoded in the junk DNA and you can't interpret it.
Man.
Blah, blah, blah.
Our testing methods are too primitive to detect the true nature of their DNA. It will only detect as regular DNA as if they were another person.
Can we go back to the fact that that guy had a soul reading?
Yeah. Yes,
what the F is that?
Wow, yeah.
Did Sly and the Family Stone do it?
That's called explaining one pseudoscience with another pseudoscience.
Right.
Was it like Otis Redding sitting in a room with a turban on his head?
Now, this person was also saying that they also bring in a whole slew of other pseudosciences. This person was saying, I've had thousands of past life since my origin, many of them on Atlantis, going on and on about
awesome.
Atlantis. Oh, Atlantis. That's what was missing from all this.
And here's a good one. It says, most star seeds came to Earth as energy and evolved into human beings on Atlantis.
We
now, energy evolving into humans. What would Darwin think of that? Energy into humans.
Energy
is beautiful.
Mass, and mass at the speed of light. Hang on. I'll figure it out.
Reading this guy's blog, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, but reading
it's a starseed.
The starseed. I'm thinking one of two things.
This
is
total
BS, or this person is completely fantasy prone.
I'm going
with
the
column A, a little
second
from
one there.
B.
But there's actually characteristics though of these starseeds. Some guy Brad Steiger wrote a book called Star People, and there's a bunch of characteristics that he's listed. And some of them was compelling eyes. Good one. Lower than normal body temperature. That was interesting.
98.5.
No, he didn't say that.
They have great magnetism.
Is a lot of people.
And personal charisma. Somehow I think a lot of these people aren't very charismatic. But my favorite, check this one out. Chronic sinusitis. What?
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
My whole life just snapped into place right then.
Jay, are you a starseed?
I've had chronic sinusitis my whole life. I mean, that explains
everything.
Well,
that's all I need to hear.
It explains the constipation. It explains the headaches.
The lavender and the two eyes and the thing.
Some of these other characteristics, though, one is have flying dreams.
Yes.
That never happens to normal people.
Who doesn't have a flying dream?
I know. And I love the percentages, Steve. 70% are this, 90% this.
So, yeah.
What, did you take a census of all starseeders? Come on.
70 to 87% have swollen or painful joints.
What?
Now they may have one slight legitimate point. I think in that we are, as Carl Sagan, of course, brought to all of our attention, we are star stuff. We are the remnants of long ago exploded stars, billions of years ago. That here we
Evan,
are today.
Evan, you're being too nice.
Yeah, I mean, that's like me saying that I'm a water nymph because we're made up of, you know,
water, yeah.
More water than anything else. Technically, I'm made up of more empty space than atoms, so I'm a ghost. You're
little atoms.
Right. This is just that segment of our society that's living in fantasy land. That's basically what.
Yeah, they're the kinds of people who create Heaven's Gate cults and, you know, go off
when they go bad.
Do you think those people? They probably have a lot of fun.
They probably enjoy themselves. I mean, they've constructed this fantasy land that, you know, gives them the illusion of something deep and meaningful in their lives. They're different. I mean, who wouldn't want to feel like they're this, you know, ancient, wise alien walking among the mere mortals? I mean, it's really a very childish fantasy.
They sound exactly like the Indigo Children stuff.
Yeah, that's right. There's overlap
We're not weird. We're special.
One more quick email. This one comes from Richard Drum, who bills himself as the astronomy bum. And Richard writes, I guess we can forget about the utility belt. This is Los Más Machos. And then he gives us a link to the e-holster.
Yes, it's awesome.
It's awesome. It's a shoulder holster like you would have for a gun, right? A shoulder holster. But it's a gadget holster. You know, you could put all your electronic gadgets
in there. It's really nerdy.
It's the equivalent of a utility belt. Not quite as sexy as a utility belt, though, I don't think.
Unless there's a gun in there.
Well, that's just it. It looks like what, you know, detectives wear to hold their guns under their coat, under their sport coat. Well,
only instead of a gun, it's nerd gear. It's not sexy, guys.
I know, but you know, Rebecca, it's not all about sex. We got to hold our stuff.
Jay.
Yes.
Okay. What did you just say?
I'm not taking
you don't
away.
Don't believe that. Don't lie to the listeners.
All right, forget it. Guys, don't wear this. It really looks like shit.
But, you know, come on. A cell phone's not really geek wear anymore. I mean, cell phones are pretty standard.
It is geek wear.
How could something ubiquitous be geek wear?
Because it's not ubiquitously sitting on your hip. That's what makes it nerdy. Having the cell phone on your person is fine, but having some kind of fanny pack or...
We're way past fanny pack here.
You have to admit the advantage of this is that it would be concealed by your jacket, just like a concealed weapon.
You know you're going to be looking at yourself in the mirror and like taking off your jacket.
Oh my God, Rebecca! No guy is going to put this thing on naked and start flexing. That's not going to happen.
Almost
doing it right
guy.
Now, aren't
Almost.
You, Jay? Jay's literally doing that right now, folks.
Yeah, I'm going to be flying in a few days, and thinking about flying and how difficult it is to get through, you know, security with all of your stuff. This would be kind of cool to have everything in the shoulder holster. You take it off, you throw it on the belt there, and then you're good to go at the other end.
Now, a jacket with an inside pocket will do that same thing, but without the necessary leather. I mean,
but it weighs you down. I mean, you ever wear a jacket with a whole bunch of stuff in your pocket? You just feel like someone's pulling on your coat.
What are you, a girl? Yeah. What do you need? Your mascara, your compact, your tampons, Evan? How much stuff are you carrying around? Seriously.
I'm not carrying any of that stuff, I assure you.
Take a man.
I don't even know what half of that
it.
Stuff is. The only thing that would make this thing cooler is if, like, it had a little badge on it, like an officer badge.
Oh God! Okay, all right. Now we're getting into the village people type shit and change the subject.
We need a skeptic badge.
Yes,
and then
we do.
Attached to this,
we really don't.
A skeptic badge.
I like when officers in the cop shows wear the badge on their belt. You know, the detectives have it just right there on the belt. That's very cool.
It seems that we've run out of time for this discussion, so let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Angie McQuaig. Angie, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Angie is here because she runs Camp Inquiry for the Center of Inquiry. So first, why don't you just tell us about that and how you got involved with the Center for Inquiry.
Sure. Well, I was originally a student activist with the Center for Inquiry when I was working on my doctorate degree and trying to bring that kind of discourse into the university where I was attending. So the Center for Inquiry is essentially a think tank that explores science and reason and the promotion of human inquiry in all sort of areas of endeavor. And so the Center for Inquiry has an arm that's an education institute. And about 4 years ago, they decided that they needed to reach a younger set. So last year, I became involved with CAMP, and I'll be the director this year.
And you have a PhD in education.
Right, in educational leadership.
Educational leadership. Great. So that pretty much is exactly what you're doing.
Exactly. But in the public schools, certainly, there's not an opportunity to promote this kind of critical thinking and skepticism. So I have to do it through nonprofits.
Okay. And tell us about Camp Inquiry. So you ran it last year. This is going to be the second year, or has it been going on longer than that?
That's right. It was originally founded in 2006, which was the first year. I think there was just a sort of small group of campers that came out. Last year we had 27, and this year we're shooting for about 60 kids. We're ready to scale it up. But essentially what we focus on is this sort of skeptical perspective and scientific inquiry in all areas of life. We also focus a lot on character development and ethical choice making, in addition to appreciation for the arts and nature.
So it's a nerd camp is what you're saying.
It's a total geek camp.
Yeah.
We have geek flags and we're flying them.
Right.
You know, there are a few other camps where the skeptical community might come and, you know, be together in camp, but they don't really focus on that. It's just a place, you know, other camps that are called our competitors, per se, really just sort of do regular camp things among those that are of like mind. But
right.
We actually focus on the issues, and we discuss them openly and overtly and invite scientists and magicians and folks to come out to really address the concerns that are on these kids' minds, and concerns where they really don't have an outlet in the public schools for vetting.
Mm-hmm. How old are the kids typically? What's the age range?
The age range is 7 to 16,
mm-hmm.
And it's about 50-50 younger kids and older kids. So, you know, we split up our activities to suit their developmental
Does
ages.
That mean you're going to reject my application?
You know, it's funny. Last year we got a lot of press about camp, and I had a number of adults saying, you know, can't you extend to age 20? And, gosh, I wish I had this when I was a kid. So,
yeah.
Jay, sorry.
Oh, well.
But do you also roll that in with other typical camp activities as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a typical day is, you know, you sort of get up and everybody comes and has a communal breakfast and we, you know, talk about what we're going to do for the day. We have sporting events every afternoon. And of course, there's nothing, no camp without a campfire.
Yeah.
We roast marshmallows and we do those things. But the kind of discussion and the richness of it really surrounds issues that these kids are concerned about. So religion is obviously a topic that comes up, you know, scientific inquiry comes up of their own volition. So it's amazing how little camp, you know, counselors have to do to evoke that kind of really erudite discussion. I mean, the kids really blow me away with their prowess in these domains, and they're very well read. They've read The Origin of Species. I was surprised.
So would you say that this camp is for people that are already science-minded, or would this be a good introduction for a kid to go to get an idea of like science's role in society and how to be more mindful of things like that?
Yeah, my observation initially was that there was a wide diversity of interests, but certainly you wouldn't select a camp like this unless it was, you know, right up your alley. It's funny because as parents were dropping their kids off last year, I interviewed every one of them and said, you know, what do you want your kids to get out of this? One parent said, can you turn them into an atheist in a week because, you know, their grandmother's Catholic? No, that's not our goal, ever. But, you know, others, it's folks like your listeners who would be interested in sending your kids there, because yes, they certainly do have an inherent appreciation for scientific inquiry and a skeptical perspective. There was enough variation to have real discourse on some, you know, on truth claims and the kinds of things that we examine, the kinds of things that you talk about on your show.
Actually, a lot of our listeners would be the kids who would go to the camp. We have certainly teenage listeners.
How do you split up the kids? You have 7 to 10 year olds, and then 11 to 13. How does that work?
what we try to do is focus the curricula around themes and then adjust based on the developmental level of the group. So we might split them in half and have a discussion about skepticism, but you know, we'll tone it down and really talk to kids at a level that they can understand and at a level in which they can really fully participate. So DJ Grothy came out last year, host of Point of Inquiry, and had a discussion with the teenagers about skepticism, and he described it beautifully as a sort of intellectual self-defense, which I really appreciated that. He said, you know, how many of you take karate? And they sort of all explained stories and shared narratives of their lives of how they apply skepticism to a number of claims, you know, advertising on cereal boxes and things that they're, you know, their friends might say. So we keep it pretty real and close to their experience, because we want them to walk away with tools, not just us telling them about what they should be skeptical.
Angie, you and I had previously had a discussion about how teachers don't really know how to teach and how there aren't really any standards for the way that teachers teach. And I was curious to know about, you know, from your background and your education, it seems like you focus a lot on the quality of teaching from our discussion. So I was curious to ask you about what you think the future is in that. Like, I have the idea that I think that teachers could really benefit from this kind of camp as well, maybe even help them improve the way that they teach science or that science comes across in the classroom.
The first thing to say about that is federal legislation has forced us into a corner, right? We have No Child Left Behind that tells us we have to have kids meet certain test scores, or schools are going to be closed down, and money's going to be restricted. And what that does is it skews the curriculum away from critical thinking and onto the regurgitation of facts. And regurgitation of facts has absolutely nothing to do with scientific inquiry or critical analysis of any topic, for that matter. And so one reason that I get so much of a kick out of working with the kids at Camp Inquiry and in my other nonprofit endeavors is that both experientially and didactically, we can give kids tools for critically analyzing any subject in any domain of their life. So yes, teachers need support in this area, but more than that, education needs to be reformed from the top down. Because, you know, if we fill kids' heads with facts that they can regurgitate at the end of the year on a bubble sheet, we've not given them tools. We've given them a list of things that they know. And so what we do at Camp Inquiry is we give kids intellectual tools, analysis tools that they can apply for the rest of their lives, we hope.
So clearly, the quality of science education is not what it should be in this country. And it seems that there's a huge variation in that quality, which is dependent upon largely the background and the ability, the knowledge, and the style of the science teacher. If you have a good science teacher, they can teach kids critical thinking and understanding of science. Lacking that, there doesn't seem to be any textbook or anything that's really going to fix the problem. So is there any hope of really achieving the kind of science education that we need in this country? And if so, what do you think is the path? How do we get there?
Yeah. Well, the way we get there is first in our language. Science teachers don't teach science. They facilitate students constructing their own learning about science, because science is not something that you can read. Science is something you do. And so the most important aspect of doing science is applying a method, a scientific method that has borne out to be an effective way of garnering knowledge, right? We have great respect for it. And so until kids do science and understand the process of the scientific method by doing it, and you can't show that on a bubble sheet, right? There just is no measure other than observation, which we know. So the way we need to reform it is that science needs to be done, not taught. We construct our own knowledge in the science classroom.
I agree with that, but the problem as I see it is that that concept essentially has already existed in science education, but it resulted in mindlessly following laboratory experiments that are laid out for you in the textbook. So the kids are doing it. You know, in other words, they are following up science lessons with hands-on laboratory experiments, but the problem is they're mindless. They're not doing it in their head. So again, I agree with the concept, but I think that that concept is already out there, but the execution utterly failed.
Right. And one way that we address that at Camp Inquiry, just as an example, is it's much more open. Students design their own both methodological plan for how they're going to collect data and analyze it at camp. And this happens every day. So every day at camp, kids will be discussing with our staff, and many of them are scientists, they'll be discussing with their staff what they want to learn about something, what their hypotheses are. So that is a departure from your suggestion that most scientific experiments in you know, a chemistry lab in high school, for example, come out of a book or, you know, turn to page 37 and follow the steps. Again, that's not doing science. That's following a process that's preset.
Yeah, it's following a cookbook, as we say.
Exactly, right.
Well, everything is taught, though.
That's the way most things are taught. It's very didactic. And again, the problem with education, in my view, is again, it goes back to our language. We say that we're teachers, but really teaching is, in my view, an impossibility. What we are is facilitators of students constructing their own learning, if real learning is to happen, right? You construct it yourself. I can't sort of open your head and put it in there.
Well, I agree with you to some extent. I mean, I think that there's a balance. I mean, science does require a certain body of factual knowledge, because, you know, just being able to think scientifically is great, but if it's in a vacuum of facts, it doesn't get anywhere either. So, in my opinion, I think there needs to be a certain balance. That's one of the challenges of science, and we actually discussed this on a recent episode with Massimo Piliucci, is that there's a lot of information that we have, you know, scientific information is very dense. How do you get that across while still having time to teach people or to facilitate them learning how to think scientifically?
Right, exactly. And that's why you see a review of literature for any research paper that you read. Of course, everything that we do, I mean, just to formulate a concept for a scientific experiment requires a lot of background knowledge.
Right.
You know, and just to formulate a theory or a hypothesis requires such. And of course, there are certainly times in a classroom where a didactic approach makes sense. But I would submit that, you know, students should be spending more than 50% of their time constructing and investigating in almost every domain of education.
Well, I mean, but how do you come up with that figure? To play devil's advocate a little bit, I think part of the problem, and where I'm going with this, is that you may be right. I don't really know. What I think is that we need more evidence-based teaching, not just an idea that sounds good. It may actually have some legitimacy to it, but maybe we need to have some. There doesn't seem to be any process by which we figure out which teaching methods actually work better in the real world.
Yeah, well, you know, 50% is something of an arbitrary figure. But, you know, if I'm standing in front of a classroom and I know that at the end of the day I want students to have met certain outcomes, I would like to provide them with more of a structure and be more of a facilitator and encourage inquiry. So if I say to a student, for example, I want you to use these materials to make rain. So I've given you ice and I've given you a steam, you know, some steam, and I've given you a big metal bucket, and I'm dealing with second graders. I'm not going to tell them, put the ice in the bowl and let the steam come up and rise above it and watch the condensation happen. I'm going to let them fumble around for a little bit, right? Because that's how learning becomes sort of concretized, right? Failing, that's part of science. It's what we want them to do.
Yeah, so it's the idea that they are going to work through the problem themselves. It's not just saying, step A, step B, step C. They're coming up with the steps. They're coming up with the discovery process of how to get to that conclusion.
Exactly. And then, you know, in sort of a backwards model, that's the time when I might then be more didactic and direct and explain to them what they just observed, which is condensation, right? Which is a model for rain. So our typical model of let me teach you this and then let me show you is not as effective in my view, and if you're sort of a constructivist, than letting you fiddle around and play with it and go, oh my gosh, look what I just did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I think science is best taught as a puzzle to be solved. At the end of the day, you have to make sure that all the kids get through it and get the knowledge out of it that they need. They have to get the factual information that they need. But just challenging them to think about something in a scientific way and constantly asking the question, how do we know that? Or, you know, how do we know what we know? I think just that in and of itself would go a long way, I think, to getting people to think more critically and more scientifically.
If you think about the science education in terms of three domains, one is dispositions, as you were just suggesting. How do we think about science? One is skills. How do you do it? Right. And one is process. Mm-hmm. Right. What are the skills you need to do? And what's the process that's logical that I must follow? And, you know, we've got the scientific method. There are a number of variations. But so students develop appreciation for that. That's the disposition. And that just comes from seeing that it works. And you can't see that it works if you just watch someone else do it or you pop in, you know, a streaming video for students. They need to experience it.
Well, Angie, thanks for talking to us about all your projects. You sound very energetic and enthusiastic, and we certainly share your mission and hope you keep up the good work.
Great. Thank you all.
Thanks, Angie.
Thanks, Angie.
Have a good night.
And now, Randy speaks.
Good morning, good afternoon, or whenever. I'm James Randi. Traveling some 800 miles north to the beautiful city of Vancouver, Canada, where I lectured just last week at the University of British Columbia, I found that I had mixed feelings about the condition of rationality in my homeland. I had to go out and purchase some homeopathic remedies for a demonstration that I regularly give at such lectures. I had little problem finding some Zicam, which, as we know, advertises itself as being homeopathic, but actually has real but doubtful medical content. It uses the homeopathic label so that the consumer can be charged a much higher price, thinking that this is one of these new, scientific, exciting approaches to medicine, which it's not. This makes Zicam one of the faked fakes. I was also able to find a box of Calms Forte sleeping pills with little trouble. These are the pills that I swallow at my lectures, the full 36 tablets that come in the box, to demonstrate that I can take 10 times the recommended dosage at the beginning of my lecture of this homeopathic medicine, and still finish an hour and a half later without even taking a nap. Are these expensive pills just slow-acting? No, they simply don't work. But more of that in a moment. A side note, the label on the box cautions, and I quote, "In case of accidental overdose, contact a poison control center immediately." Duh. When it came to finding one of the counterfeit detector pens that I use in my lecture, it was a little more difficult. Hilariously, I discovered that the Drymark company, who manufactures this fake device, have different standards of deception for Canada than they do for the United States. I say hilariously because changing the standards for something that doesn't work anyway is pretty funny. I think you'll agree. And they've turned out a new version of this pen, which doesn't work either. I also showed my audience that not only the detector pen, but another fraudulent device, an expensive but useless UV light that is supposed to identify counterfeit money, simply did not work by performing a live demonstration in which a $10 bill printed on Xerox copier registered as genuine, even though there was a liquor ad printed on the reverse. Ah, but to return to that pill-chugging demo that I did, you may recall that a while back when I spoke for the TED conference in California, I performed this suicide by quackery thing, and an angry internet columnist named Jack Myers immediately rushed to his keyboard to denounce this as a fake, since he just knew that homeopathy is genuine and that I could not possibly have survived an overdose. Well, I, in turn, immediately responded to him, assuring him that it was a legitimate consumption of 36 sleeping pills, done before a trusting audience, legitimately, openly, and honestly. And I invited him, at his convenience, to witness that demo the next time I was in his area, New York. That opportunity came last year. I contacted Mr. Myers and told him where and when I would be in New York lecturing. And I asked for details of how he would like to observe that demo. I was prepared to have him supply the pills personally, administer them to me, and stay with me for the next 12 hours to assure himself that I would not die, as he was confident that I would. Oh, and I forgot to mention, Jack Myers also said that he would donate $1,000 to the James Randi Educational Foundation as soon as he was satisfied that I had done this daring deed. Well, as some of you probably know, Mr. Jack Myers retreated from his challenge and fell silent. Why? I cannot tell. Maybe he got smart by doing some research on the true nature of homeopathy, as I did, but I doubt that. In any case, I have yet to see any apology issued by him, though I can tell you that I'd much rather settle for the $1,000 donated to the foundation. Mr. Myers, neither the James Randi Educational Foundation nor I personally have ever retreated from a challenge that we've issued. We've followed through over the past more than 10 years, and we've seen others such as yourself bluster and strut about proclaiming that we're not following through, and that's simply a lie. You accused me on your internet site of being a liar and a fake. You challenged me, and I responded affirmatively. You backed down, Mr. Myers. We didn't. As for homeopathy, no greater mass delusion has ever afflicted the medical world, except perhaps for that bizarre idea that the mere royal touch of a God-appointed and anointed monarch could heal the ailments of the hoi polloi. That fantasy appears to be out of favor currently, though it may reemerge at any moment. As for homeopaths, they preach that the vibrations of long-gone substances are retained by H2O molecules and can mystically heal the sick. My ingestion of an overdose of homeopathic sleeping pills, which I've done so many times, is not at all dangerous, daring, or brave, Mr. Myers. I freely admit that to you because I'm being honest. You may be familiar with that principle. Jack Myers, are you still out there someplace? Why are you so quiet? Hello, Jack. Hello? You owe us $1,000, Jack. No? Well, that's Jack Myers, and I'm James Randi, and I thank you for your kind attention.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
And we kicked your ass last week.
I got one of you. Who did I get?
You, Jay.
I don't remember either. It was Jay, Rebecca, or Bob. That's all I know.
Titanoboa.
We have another theme this week.
Oh. Oh,
I like themes.
I know you guys love themes. And the theme this week is love. And because in a couple of days is Valentine's Day is coming up, so we're going to have a
boring
Valentine's Day just passed.
Feelings are boring. Kissing is awesome.
I love Valentine's Day.
Yeah. All right, here we go. Item number one, and this is, you know, love loosely defined. Item number one: researchers find that not only do experience gifts give longer lasting happiness than material gifts when they go well, but they produce longer-lasting unhappiness when they go bad. Item number two, research involving comparing surnames and Y chromosomes estimates that as many as 10% of the population in the UK is illegitimate. Item number three, genetic analysis shows that human ancestors contracted pubic lice from gorilla ancestors about 3.3 million years ago.
Whoa.
Love.
Yeah, you think after 3.3 million years they'd see a doctor.
Rebecca, I believe you're up to go first.
Yeah.
Why couldn't I have gone first last week when I'd read all the articles and knew the answer? As opposed to this week when I don't know nothing about no love. All right. Researchers find that not only do experience gifts give longer lasting happiness than material gifts when they go well, but they produce longer lasting unhappiness when they go bad.
Yeah, so taking your significant other to a play is an experience gift, as opposed to giving her a piece of jewelry or a box of chocolates is a material gift.
Right.
Right. Mm. Just to clarify.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then surnames and Y chromosomes, as many as 10% of the population in the UK is illegitimate. They are a bunch of limey bastards. I have heard that. So that one I can believe as well. And pubic lice, inheriting or contracting pubic lice from gorilla ancestors 3.3 million years ago. Now, we know that our ancestors did do the nasty in the pasty with gorilla ancestors. I think that's true. But I don't know about how did they find out that they got pubic lice from them? Like, is there some anthropologist who drew the short straw and is combing through some fossilized pubic hairs?
Just to say combing? Oh, God.
Looking for the disease.
Is he literally, like, looking at these fossils of pubic lice?
Oh, yeah.
My God. They went over the evidence with a fine-tooth comb.
Yeah.
You know what the really sad thing is? Bug Girl, who blogs with me on Skeptic, tweeted something about pubic lice earlier. Yeah. Yeah. And for the first time ever, I didn't have the time or the stomach to click the link.
It was fate. So I bet you the link would take you to the answer to that question.
I bet it would have. I'm going to go with the limey bastards being wrong. I think the pubic lice thing is right. You wanted to bring it up because it's pubic lice. So I'm going to go with 10% of the population in the UK is illegitimate. I think that's wrong. I think the number is much higher.
Okay. Bob?
I hate when I don't read the whole article. But you bastard. Let's see. The gift thing, I don't know. That's a tricky one because an experience gift, you go and it's done. Game over. But if it's a bad gift, like, say, an alarm clock, you got to look at that damn thing every day.
Alarm clock.
So I don't know about that one. The 10% of the population being illegitimate. Wow, that Rebecca might seem to think that sounds like too little. I think it sounds like a lot.
Well, you've never been to London.
Yes, I have. Loved it. London was awesome.
You've never f anyone in London. I'm kidding.
Eat your heart out.
And the pubic lice from gorillas. I could see that. I don't have a problem with that. I guess. I'm going to agree with Rebecca. I'm going to say that the 10% number two population being illegitimate in the UK, I'm going to say that's false.
Okay, Evan?
Yeah, that was my first inclination. That was my gut reaction, as it were. Is that the 10%? I don't like that number, that 10% of the population in the UK is illegitimate. I think that is incorrect in one way or the other. So I'll agree and say that one's false.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, I think the three of you guys pick that one because it just seems like the one that...
That is false.
It seems like the one that's false, but it also is like the easy one to pick out of the group. And I refuse to pick that one. I refuse to on the grounds that
it's...
Steve is smarter than this. I think that the first one, the one about the weird thing about the experience gifts, which everyone wants clarification on, I think that one is wordy enough this week to be false.
Huh. Okay. So you all agree that genetic analysis shows that human ancestors contracted pubic lice from gorilla ancestors about 3.3 million years ago. You all think that one is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, too gross and not to be true.
That one is science.
Oh, right.
Yay,
in a way.
Pubic lice is science. So this is genetic analysis of the lice. There are two species of lice that infect humans. Theris pubis, popularly known as crabs.
Oh, come on.
Evolved from the gorilla louse, Theris gorilla, or gorillae. And they share a common ancestor about 3.3 million years ago.
Okay.
But humans and gorillas split 7 million years ago. Therefore, the lice had to cross over 4 million or so years after the human and gorilla lines separated. Now, of course, you were all meant to think that this implied that there was some hanky-panky going on.
Well, the theme is love.
Yes, that's right. And you were meant to think that. The alternate hypothesis, of course, that's not impossible, but the alternate hypothesis is that early humans may have been slaughtering gorillas for bushmeat.
Bushmeat? That explains it.
Say it. Steve, say it.
Slaughtered. And that they could have contracted it from their prey, from their gorilla prey.
Oh, of course. Maybe they kept gorillas as pets or servants.
Servants?
I don't know.
How many gorilla servants will there be? One. He'll train others.
That one is science. We'll train one gorilla. We'll let him train all the other ones. That'll look out fine. Let's go backwards to number two.
Ooh.
Research involving comparing surnames and Y chromosomes estimates that as many as 10% of the population in the UK is illegitimate, and that one is fiction. That's the fiction.
Oh.
That is the fiction.
Oh, yeah.
That's okay. Come on, Steve. That was so predictable. I couldn't pick it.
Sometimes the predictable one has to be the answer. So, but now Rebecca, you thought that the number is actually higher. Bob, you thought the number was lower. Evan, you refused to even put your nickel down. So, come on, higher or lower?
Lower.
Lower. Jay, what do you think?
It's gotta be lower.
Lower. So, there's actually a common belief in the UK in the 10% figure that's one of those things that, you know, is in the lay culture, that 10% or 1 in 10 children is actually illegitimate. What these researchers did was they looked at a comparison of Y chromosomes and surnames. Now, for a common surname like Smith, there was no relationship, you know, between the Y chromosomes and the surname, because the name Smith is so common that any distinguishing genetic mutations would have been, you know, passed around so many times that being a Smith doesn't make you more related to other Smiths and to just any other members of the population. It's not a small enough group. But when they looked at very uncommon surnames, and they specifically mentioned four that they looked at that were very uncommon, Grucock, Wadsworth, Ketley, and Ravenscroft. Yes, you heard me correctly.
Ravenscroft?
Ravenscroft, that's a cool name.
That is a cool name.
Wait.
Hold on.
Grucock.
Steve.
Was it Grucock?
Steve, you did not just say that.
I'm just reading the name, the four uncommon surnames that they used. When they looked at those four names, they found that there was a very high correlation, and from that they estimate that about 1 in 25 or only about 4% of children are illegitimate.
There you go.
So much
lower.
Less than the commonly accepted figure of 10%. So they debunked the myth that 10% of people in the UK are illegitimate.
I say.
What was that guy's name again?
Wadsworth?
I don't know.
It's a funny name.
Maybe people with ridiculous last names actually don't sleep around as much as others.
That's true.
The English people, like about 300 years ago, had to just sit around and be like, I am going to come up with the coolest last name. Grocock. How about you? I pick Wadsworth. What is going on?
Crazy world, Jay. It's a crazy world.
But Ravenscroft is a cool name. You have to give him that.
Yeah.
Ketley.
Isn't that one of Harry Potter's schools?
Yeah, you would think. It's, yeah, Ravenscroft.
I think there's also a haunted house called Ravenscroft Manor.
That's right? Ravensloft, I believe.
Ravensloft, yeah. Which means researchers find that not only do experience gifts give longer-lasting happiness than material gifts when they go well, but they produce longer-lasting unhappiness when they go bad. And that one is science. Previous research had already established that experience gifts, taking your loved one to the theater, on a trip, whatever, produced much more lasting positive memories and feelings than a material gift does. So even though, Bob, you may have the material item around to remind you of it, we don't really attach that much emotional significance to it, whereas having an event, an experience with your loved one does have a long-lasting impact. What the new research shows is that when the experience gift is a negative one, that the bad feelings also last longer than the bad feelings from a failed material gift. So it's a high-risk game either way.
Okay.
But good job, everyone, except Jay.
bad job, Jay.
We still love you, Jay.
I took the chance.
Jay, you're not afraid to go against the herd.
No, what?
Even when it's totally wrong. Yeah. You're basically like the anti-vaccinationist, but at least you're not dangerous.
Right.
Yes.
That came out wrong.
Rebecca,
I'm sorry.
Every time you talk, all I hear is blah, 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 blah.
Wah, wah.
No.
Wah,
you
wah,
hear
wah,
blah,
wah.
Blah, 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 blah. Love you, Jay.
Evan, so who's that noisy?
All right.
Who's that noisy?
All right. Here's how we're going to do it this week, because we don't have any feedback on last week's episode yet because it has not been released.
We'll have to give it next week.
Right. Yeah, that's right. We'll give both answers in the next podcast, all right?
We won't be able to say who won until next week's show, but we can give the answer this
week. I'm confused about timey-wimey. Can someone explain it to me again?
You have to get your head and your ass wired together.
I make a Doctor Who joke and nobody gets it.
Doctor Who? Oh, gosh,
Doctor
Rebecca.
Who?
Why don't you go live in
Doctor
London
Who.
At this point? My
sorry.
God. It's better than your stupid Star Trek or whatever.
Oh, my God, Doctor Who. Oh, look, Doctor Who's on.
Whatever, man. Just because David Tennant doesn't wear a fanny pack with all of his sonic screwdrivers all over it and shit.
No, he pops around in a phone booth.
Oh, like, yeah, because that's not nearly as cool as the four-door sedan that you drive around town.
That's right. You got that right.
Come on. Steve's ride is sweet.
I mean, come on. You know, everyone knows time machines go in DeLoreans, not in phone booths. Come on. Anyway, Evan, so give us the who, tell us the who's that noisy from last week.
All right. Do you guys need to hear it again?
Yes, we'll play it again. And here it is. Ready?
And that noise is, in fact, the noise of a caterpillar. And wow. This,
what? Caterpillars don't make noise.
Caterpillars most definitely make noises. Not only do they make noises, but they make noises to trick ants. They're making ant noises, actually. And they're
ants
tricking them
noise?
Into doing services for them. And this comes from Science News.
Sexy services?
A Science News article that came out February 5th. They say that a kind of European caterpillar can garner royal treatment from ants by mimicking the chick, 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 chick of their queen. So basically they work their way into the colony. They can camouflage themselves. The ants let them into the colony. And then they go the extra step by imitating the noises of the queen. So that,
what, the ants feed them? Is that what they do?
Yeah, they just do whatever it is the caterpillar wants them to do.
He does the old Jedi mind trick on them?
Yeah, basically. And gets them to, I guess, protect them, bring them food, do whatever it is that.
Well, ants are stupid.
Isn't that fascinating, though? They can record the sound of a caterpillar imitating an ant. That's just remarkable.
So this is like the real life version of that grasshopper and the ant fable, and it has the opposite.
Yeah, model. Yeah.
Just make the ant do the work for you.
That's.
Go relax. It's cool.
Well, nature doesn't care about morality. It just is what it is.
They'll kill their own brood and feed it to the caterpillar. So it is a way for the caterpillar to get food.
So the caterpillar says, basically, I want you to kill your children and feed them to me. And the ants go, sure, here you go.
That's a good idea, your majesty.
You sound like the queen. Okay.
Okay, well, why don't we move on to this
week? So who's that noisy this week?
Who's that noisy? Are you folks ready? Here
ready.
It comes.
When I go into a home, I'm not looking for devils. I'm not looking for ghosts. What I'm looking for is a natural explanation as to what's going on. Something physical in the house. Only when I find that there is something supernatural, something paranormal, do I accept it. And that has to be proven to me 100%. Mm-hmm. I have to see a table moving across the room.
James Randi.
There you go. Now, I'm sure we all have our ideas who exactly said that, but you, the listeners, you have to go out and guess and figure out who said that and send in your answers.
Can you tell us how old that recording is?
No.
Okay.
I can't.
Can you tell us who made the recording?
Yes, but that would be giving away the answer.
Can you tell us who's that noisy?
All right. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks.
That's
good
intriguing
luck,
as always. Jay, give us the quote to close out this stellar episode.
I have a quote from Karl Popper.
Yes. Mr. Popper.
Mr. Papa. Karl was an Austrian and British philosopher and a professor at the London School of Economics. And Karl said or wrote, "The scientific tradition is distinguished from the pre-scientific tradition in having two layers. Like the latter, it passes on its theories, but it also passes on a critical attitude towards them. The theories are passed on, not as dogmas, but rather with the challenge to discuss them and improve upon them." That was sent in by Paul Southworth. And that quote is from Karl Popper.
A little known fact is that Karl Popper also developed a tasty appetizer of cream cheese and jalapeno. Often found at
the jalapeno poppers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's true. And he was a very good friend of Robert Bloom and Onion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Wow.
And he had a tremendous singing voice.
And he was a Virgo.
And what was his blood type?
B positive.
B positive.
Be positive.
Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
Oh, come on, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Wonderful.
Our pleasure.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.